The song of Christmas time. Silent night. Winter nights. Snowy nights. Sleigh bells. A wonderful feeling, a wonderful spirit. Something we ought to keep all year long.
At home with the elves. Because the world of the elves is closely bound up with our own, it is in our best interest to stay on the good side of these mysterious creatures. In the old days, this might mean the pouring of milk, blood, and even gifts of gold and silver into their earthen houses. Nowadays, it can be as simple as showing kindness and respect to a stranger, because you just never know. The elves in this chapter have no interest in making toys or becoming dentists, nor are they particularly small. They have, however, always been a part of Christmas, even if their feast was originally held in October. We know that the Feast of the Elves was called Elfablot, or Elf Sacrifice, and we know that it took place in southwestern Sweden, but we do not know exactly what took place. In fact, we know almost nothing about Elfablot, and that is the fault of a rather ill-tempered old farm wife who lived in the settlement of Hof in the year 1017. But before we take her to task, we must answer a question. Who exactly are the elves? I'm not going to try to pronounce this, so I'm going to say Hvat er med alfom, or what's with the elves, asks the prophetess in the Old Norse poem Veluspa. Veluspa. You may be asking the same question, for it is not yet December, and the battered rinds of the neighbor's jack-o'-lanterns are still moldering at the curb, while the Thanksgiving turkey cools its heels in the freezer. Vat er med elfom, indeed. The ancient Scandinavians regarded the elfar as a distinct class of beings, though there was some fluidity among the bloodlines of elves, gods, norns, and even humans. I've learned from my supposed obsession with Christmas lore is that elves are older than Jesus. This may come as a surprise to some of you, and more like an of course they are surprise to others. Elves are extremely important to Scandinavia in more ways than their ancient culture. They still exist to many. We don't know for sure what was sacrificed to elves, at least in post-Christian days when stuff went underground for a while. But I will leave that stuff to the book, Old Magic of Christmas, written by Linda Radish. Let me tell you who she is according to her biography. Linda Radish is the author of Night of the Witches, Folklore Traditions and Recipes for Celebrating Walpurgis Night, and The Old Magic of Christmas, Yuletide Traditions for the Darkest Days of the Year. She's a frequent guest on the paranormal talk radio circuit. Linda resides in northern New Jersey, where she is currently at work on a third book about witches to appear in August 2017, in plenty of time for Halloween. In the meantime, you can catch her work in Llewellyn's Sabbat's Almanac, Witch's Companion, and Herbal Almanac. Linda welcomes readers to contact her through her Facebook page. So, don't let that scare you. This really is some compelling stuff.
Sing together and make the mood merry. with a carol of bells that are frightfully scary.
Crashing through the night with a horrid mangling sound, clang each heart with fright, terrorize the town. Bells from belfries ring, making spirits rise. The freaky tones like voices moan throughout the midnight skies. Oh, scary bells, scary bells, ring your ghostly call. Oh, what fun it is to scream and terrorize us all. Oh, scary bells, with your manic sound. When you toll the spirits, roll them 6 feet underground. Ago, I thought I'd take a ride to see the mansion sights, to see what was inside. My horse began to rear, the scary bells did clang. I fell into an open grave. To cheer myself, I sang. Oh, scary bells, ring your ghostly call. Oh, what fun it is to scream and terrorize us all. Oh, scary bells, with your manic sound. When you toll the spirits, roll from 6 feet underground. When you toll the spirits, roll from 6 feet underground.
Ooh. 13th century Icelandic poet Snorri Sturluson offers us not one race of elves, but two. Light elves, whom Sturluson likens to the sun, lived in Elfheim, or Elfholm, which was located somewhere in the heavens. The dark elves, who were blacker than pitch, dwelt deep inside the earth. From earliest times, or in the Bronze Age at least, elves were associated with the sun. In Sweden, cup-shaped depressions can be found in rocks, bearing carvings of what we presume to be sun moons. These stone cups held offerings of milk, which rural Swedes continued to pour out for the elves into the 20th century. An old Norse kenning for the sun itself is Elfrödil, or Glory of the Elves. The elves' role as intermediaries between mortals and the life-giving sun helps to explain their shining aspect. The highly literate Snorri Sturluson divided the elves neatly into light and dark, but this does not mean they were so divided throughout the Nordic world, or that every peasant who sought practical help from the elves was aware of such a division. The elves might have shone like the sun, but they were also very much of the earth. Because they were believed to be physically present in the landscape, they were often of more immediate importance to the farmer than were the mighty gods. It is possible that propitiation of the elves preceded worship of the gods, just as it has long outlived it in the general population, for the story of the elves does not end with Ragnarok, the fiery demise of the old Norse worldview.
Here's that time of year again,
from now on your troubles will be out.
Will you know more? Vitod Eren, the Veluspa prophetess, goes on to ask as she describes the end of the world. While many of the chieftains and kings of Northern Europe were able to trade in Odin for Christ without much thought, the tillers of the soil had been working on their relationship with the elves for thousands of years, and they were not about to give them up so easily. Rather than let the elves go, they resettled them within a Christian cosmology. In this new world, the elves were semi-fallen angels. When Lucifer rose up against God, the elves, or fairies, failed to choose sides, and so they were not cast all the way down, but were doomed to haunt the wild places of the earth until Judgment Day. The idea that these creatures of light reached their state because of the actions of the Angel of Light fit neatly with the old beliefs. Another, rather more amusing theory has to do with an unexpected visit God paid to Adam and Eve long after they had been expelled from the Garden of Eden and set up house for themselves. By this time, they had so many children that Eve couldn't keep them all properly bathed, so she presented to God only the ones who had just come out of the tub. When God asked to see the rest of the children, Eve denied that there were any, having sent the filthy ones to hide in the backyard. She had apparently not learned her lesson about lying to an omniscient deity. God declared that those children whom Eve had hidden from him would remain hidden from all mankind. The descendants of these grubby children are the Hidden Folk, as they are known in Iceland to this day. Of course, not everyone is satisfied with such apocryphal explanations. From the early to mid-20th century, it was fashionable to identify the elves and fairies as Europe's first settlers. In his 1955 book, Witchcraft Today, original Wiccan, Gerald Gardner, equated them with the Picts and other tribes whose desire to keep the old ways in the face of Christianity sent them scurrying to the furthermost reaches of the Celtic realm, to the barren mountaintops, and to dark holes in the hills, where they could continue to practice their own brand of earthly magic.
Or wheeling around in the sky. Believe one phone call erased 10,000 bail. By some strange note, Santa called me, said he needed 10 grand just to set himself free. I told him I'd get on it and do what I could do, but I can't make anyone believe my story is true. Just trying to help Santa, I don't mean no harm. Now they're trying to put me in the funny barn. They impounded Santa's sleigh and his reindeer too, and they'll probably end up in the city zoo. And there won't be any Santa next Christmas Eve. I can't raise his bail, no one will believe. Santa got a DWI for weaving around in the sky. Believe me, I won't lie. Whoa, Santa got a DWI. There's a moral to the song, don't be mad at that. If you have a few nippers, better catch a cab. Don't ever try to drive if you can't walk, 'cause even old Santa ain't above the law. Santa got a DWI for weaving around in the sky. Believe me, I wouldn't lie. Oh, Santa got a DWI. Santa got a DWI for weaving around in the sky.
Already a small race compared to the Romano Britons and Anglo-Saxons, their children were made smaller still by the deprivations of a life in hiding. These aboriginal pixies, a corruption of Picts, as Gardner would have it, kept very much to themselves, stealing only out at night to pinch butter, milk, and the occasional cow from their more agriculturally advanced neighbors. In between times, they occupied themselves with their ancient rituals and with making stone arrowheads tipped with poison or elf shot. What did these pixies look like? No doubt their hair was knotted into elf locks for want of a good comb maker, and at one time it was common knowledge that they were red-haired. In Washford Market, Somerset, they were also thought to be cross-eyed and to have pointed ears, short faces, and turned-up noses. The observation that redheads could pop up unpredictably in otherwise blonde or dark-haired families may have had to do with this belief. Rather than attribute such children's coloring to a recessive gene or to the milkman, parents might regard them as changelings, the cast-off progeny of the pixies. We know from the Romans that the Picts brushed themselves with a blue paint that may have been mineral-derived, though the more popular explanation is that it was derived from indigo, extracted from the woad plant. According to Gardner, when they wanted to go unnoticed, they mixed this blue colorant with a dye made from the yellow-flowered weld, the result being a whole race of tiny men and women roaming the moors in varying shades of blue and Lincoln green, the latter eventually becoming the national color of faery. Like their Neolithic ancestors, these beleaguered but colorful little people maintained homes of dry stone construction half sunk in the earth, perhaps even elaborate complexes of them as can be seen at Skara Brae in the far north of Scotland. Since the whole house was covered in grass or heather, it would have looked to the casual eye like a natural feature of the landscape. If one of the big people happened to be passing by on a winter's night and witnessed the opening of a well-concealed door, he could not have failed to notice the blaze of hearth light staining the snow as it does at the doors of elvish abodes in so many folk tales of northwestern Europe.
Hey, deck a horse with weeds and leaves. Oh, jolly rally, ooba dooba shooba da. How's a bob rolling up some holly? Jolly lolly lolly jolly ooba dooba doo. Done we now our gay apparel. Oops, my dear, and a happy new year. Troll the ancient Yuletide carol. Ooba ooba dooba dooba shooba dooba doo. Hey, jolly old St. Nicholas, lean your ear this way. Don't you ever tell a single soul what I'm gonna say. Christmas Eve is coming soon, and you're a hip old man. Just whisper in my ear what you're gonna bring to me, and bring it in a can. Don't forget to bring it in a can. Santa Claus, Santa Claus, Santa Claus, this is all I ask. All I want for Christmas is a stocking full of splamba hooby hooby dooba. Hey, just make sure that it's pure, manicured, and slava dava shoo shoo be doo shoo shoo be doo be doo shoo be ooby 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 ooby. Blasting through the snow, hey, flying all the way over those fields we go. Yeah, laughing in the sleigh, bells on bobtails swing. Hey, all them heads is bright. Ooh, what kicks it is to sing a funky tune tonight. Now Johnny, he wants a pair of skates, Susie wants a sled. Now Nellie, she wants a picture book, yellow, blue, and red. Now I think I'm gonna leave to you what to give the rest. Hey, you know all about me there, Sammy. You know I dig the best. That's why I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. Yeah, just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten and the children listen for the ice cream man, or snow, or sleigh bells in the snow. It's all according to wherever you are. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. Hey, with every Christmas card I write. Now may your days be merry and bright, and may all your Christmases be bright, bright, out of sight. Yeah, have a groovy good night, good night. A merry, merry, merry Christmas and a happy new year. To you and you and you and you. Oh. Thank you.
There would have to have been smoke holes in those hollow hills, through which the scents of the bracken fire and roasted shrew could have escaped, but these details are seldom present in the folklore. Gardner insists that most of the comings and goings would have been through those primitive chimneys, which only added to the pixies' exoticism in the eyes of their neighbors. Unfortunately, this Gardnerian version of elvish origins probably has a lot more romance in it than truth. Instead, Gardner's concept of the mighty dead might give us a better idea of who the elves really are. The mighty dead are the spirits of magical practitioners, witches, if you will, who, through a series of reincarnations, have honed their skills to the point where they, in death, have become objects of worship, or at least consultation. Well, the elves were certainly revered, but one would hesitate to call them mighty, especially in the Scandinavian folktales that were first recorded in the 19th century by roving ethnographers inspired by the Brothers Grimm. The elves appear to carry on lives that parallel those of their human neighbors. They move their cattle from one pasture to another and spread their hay to dry in the sun. They cook, clean, and concern themselves with the welfare of the children. They even attend their own church services, though they appear not to have undergone either Reformation or Counter-Reformation, even in those countries where the humans were staunchly Protestant. Often, the elves are possessed of an unearthly beauty, but just as often, they appear as ordinary people, albeit in quaint dress. If the elves resemble us, it is because they are us, or rather they were. The human who stumbles upon a procession of elves or an impromptu elvish feast is often startled to recognize someone he knows among them, someone who has died either recently or years before. Often, this dead acquaintance advises the human witness how to safely leave the party, the standard precaution being not to touch the food. The elves, then, are the dead, not the quietly resting dead, but those who, for whatever reason, have taken up new lives on the other side of the veil, and at times, either knowingly or unknowingly, might come strolling back through it.
I'm going home for the North Honey Christmas. Going home to the hills of Tennessee. The folks will be at the depot to meet me. and home for the North and Clinton. Oh, oh, here's a hit of the
Among these elves are the long dead, who speak a language the barest traces of which are remembered in the names of hillocks that used to be mountains, or of rivers that have long ago changed course. The bones of these people have become fully incorporated into the soil, yet still they rattle about the landscape on their elvish business. They no longer remember any other kind of existence, and may be only dimly aware of developments since their passing. They're troubled by the tolling of church bells and might be scalded by the dripping of holy water into their homes, not to mention the seeping of car exhaust, for these things belong to a world they no longer do. The more recently dead, in their petticoats and high-crowned hats, have crossed over just long enough ago not to notice anything strange about the banquet, how the candles blaze but never burn down, how the platters of cakes are never diminished. But the sweetheart who was put in the churchyard just last week has not yet been fully absorbed into the company of elves. She can still remember who belongs on which side of the divide, and will do what she can to prevent her living loved ones from being taken up prematurely by the dead. It is time now to join Sigvat the Skald, or court poet, on a journey he has undertaken through southwestern Sweden on behalf of the Norwegian king Olav. It is the beginning of winter. Since this is the Viking age, in which the year was divided into a summer and a winter half, this puts us somewhere around the time of our Halloween. No doubt snow has already fallen on the forest of Eidaskog, though the river is not yet frozen. Sigvat and his small party of king's men are cold, footsore, and probably hungry to boot. Darkness is falling as they emerge from the woods at Hov, in search of beds or at least a pile of straw for the night. They approach the first farm they see, but the door is barred. As Sigvat attempts to stick his nose in the crack, it is explained to him by those within that he has arrived at a holy time, that the space inside is already consecrated, and he may not enter.
Jingle, 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 dashing through the snow, in a one-horse open sleigh, o'er the fields we go, laughing all the way,
ho, ho, ho.
Bells on bobtails ring, making spirits bright, what fun it is to ride and sing a sleighing song tonight. Oh, jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. A day or two ago, I thought I'd take a ride. Soon Miss Fanny Bright was seated by my side.
You know the
horse was lean and lank. Misfortune was his loss. He got into a drifted bank, and we did get up soft. Oh, jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. In a one-horse open sleigh, laughing all the way. In a one-horse open
Since this is no church, but a farmhouse, Sigvat, an Icelandic Christian, assumes correctly that it is a heathen observance. He curses the farmer either for his lack of hospitality or his backward ways or both, and goes on his way. Skald and King's men continue to the next farmyard, where they are again turned away, this time by an old woman who calls Sigvat a wretch and informs him that they are holding an offering to the elves. Her use of the third person suggests she may be a servant sent by family to get rid of the unwanted visitors. We can only wish she'd opened the door, for the compulsive versifier Sigvat would surely have left us a detailed, if biased, description of the ceremony had he been allowed inside to witness it. As it is, we can only wonder, how is the family dressed? In workaday clothes or in special garments reserved for the occasion? Did lights burn within? How was the table laid? Or was all the action going on in the enclosed courtyard? We cannot lay all the blame at the feet of the old hag, as Sigvat calls her, for Sigvat's behavior is just as intolerable. Though an Icelander and a Christian, Sigvat is presumably of Norwegian descent. He should therefore have been familiar with the Disablot, or sacrifice to the Disir, which his own heathen grandparents and possibly even parents would have celebrated at winter nights at the same time of year. The Disablot took place before an altar dedicated to the Disir, ancestral female spirits who are precursors of our fairy godmothers and a few of our witches too. There's a lot of overlap between the Disir and the Norns who sat spinning among the roots of the world tree. Like the Disir, the Norns occasionally made house calls, but all in all were considered to be more aloof than the Disir. Sometimes the Disir behaved more like bloodthirsty Valkyries than fairy godmothers, and in fact the Disablot altar was reddened with blood, though we are not sure whose. In the saga of Hervor and King Heidrek, the Disabloat is presided over by one princess Elfhild of Elfheim, so it is possible that the Elfabloat and Disabloat were precisely the same thing. Had Sigvat shown a little respect for the traditions of Hove, he might have been allowed to slip quietly inside and take part in the feast. He might even have been asked to play his harp, if harp he had, and if his fingers were not too stiff with cold, for it was not unheard of for a Christian to join in heathen rituals in times of need. In the saga of Eric the Red, Sigvat's fellow Icelander, Gudrid, now a Christian, is persuaded to assist the prophetess Thorbjorg by chanting the magical formula she had learned as a child. Unfortunately, there was no such syncretism that evening in Hove, and Sigvat is turned away by four more Bonders before he gives up his search for hospitality. When he finally arrives at his ultimate destination, the hall of Ragnvald the Jarl, he is rewarded with a gold ring and sympathy, so you really can't feel sorry for Sigvat. Was the Elfabloat unique to that district of Sweden? The only other reference we have to a sacrifice made to the elves occurs in Cormac's saga. Here, a witch directs the wounded Thorvald to invoke the healing power of the elves by pouring bull's blood on a nearby elf mound and making a feast of the meat for the elves dwelling within. Could the Hovians have been sacrificing something more precious than livestock? Human sacrifice was certainly not unknown at this time in this part of the world, but had that been the case, then surely the farm folk would have dissembled in front of the Christian Sigvat pleading sickness in the house rather than announcing the occasion of a sacrifice. And whereas a portion of the livestock had to be slaughtered at the onset of winter anyway, humans were valuable members of the workforce and not to be dispatched lightly. So why the secrecy? The celebrants may have been in the process of inducing a trance state in one or more of the family members, or even of a visiting prophetess like Thorbjorg. The speaking of prophecies serves as the highlight of several feasts in the Old Norse sagas. Much work went into preparing both the speaker and the space, so if this were the case, it is no wonder the old woman was short with Sigvard. She would have been eager to learn what the future held for her, and therefore anxious not to break the spells that have been woven about the scrying platform. Ironically, the man who sent Sigvat on his errand in the first place, the Christian King Olav, was in some respects an elf himself. Though Olav denied even the possibility, a few of his followers believed him to be the reincarnation of an earlier king, Olaf Geirstadr, who upon his death and laying in how, i.e. in his grave mound, received both offerings and the epithet of elf after his name. It is also interesting to note that Hove lay just to the east of the limits of a kingdom still known in the early Middle Ages as Elfheim. Scholars agree that the name has nothing to do with elves, but refers instead to the bed of gravel that lies beneath the tillable soil of this district, a fact that Tolkien fans will quickly forget when they hear that, in the 9th century, Elfheim was ruled by a king named Gandalf. According to one of the Fornaldr sagas, or sagas of ancient days, the inhabitants of this early Elfheim were so fair of face that only the Rísir outshone them. As to who the Rísir were, I suppose that is another story. You probably have to clean house before Thanksgiving anyway, so why not host your own Elfoboat this year?
Thank you. much to drink. Ain't got no bail, ain't got no bail, and I'm spending New Year's Eve in the clink. I was in the wrong lane, feeling no pain. Souped my car to 75, ran right into, you can guess who, and they say I'm lucky to be alive.
Merry Christmas, Happy New Year.
They're singing down the street while everybody's having Christmas turkey. They give me bread and water to eat. Christmas in jail, Christmas in jail. Wore my shoes out pacing the floor. Got rocks in my head, I wish I was dead. Ain't gonna drink and drive no more.
Merry Christmas, Happy New Year.
They're singing down the street while everybody's having Christmas turkey. They give me bread and water to eat. Christmas in jail, Christmas in jail. Wore my shoes out pacing the floor. Got rocks in my head, I wish I was dead. Ain't gonna drink and drive no more. Ain't gonna drink and drive no more. Ain't gonna drink and drive no more.
Merry Christmas!
I'm about to go to my solstice party, one I've been looking forward to for a month. I made mushroom and reindeer cookies. Not the ingredients, silly. The mushroom cookies came out so beautifully. I must share my technique with you. You see, I don't like how my icing tastes when red gel paste is added. In order to get a nice scarlet color, you have to add a great deal of gel paste. So what I did was, I iced the stem and made a few dots on the top of the Amanita muscaria and waited several hours for everything to dry completely. Then I iced around the dots and spooned red sparkling sugar all over the wet icing. I'm sure sanding sugar would look just as nice. They're absolutely beautiful. The reindeer are nice too, but you really have to work with a good chocolate to get a nice smooth surface. If you're going to replace icing with it, that is. Sometimes, though, a nice lemony icing tastes better than melted white chocolate, believe it or not. It's your choice, but I recommend trying melted chocolate on Christmas cookies. You can dye the white stuff to any color you want. It looks great when enhanced by colored sugar. It hides the bumps. Just don't melt it at too high power in the microwave because it may clump or burn. Also, omit leavening from the cookie recipe to get a nice sharp shape. Anyway, that's all for now. Visit me on Facebook under Allison Randall, one L in Allison, or mondodiablo.wordpress.com. See you later.